So NVIDIA is the talk of the town when it comes to generative AI, AI stocks, and chip stocks in general. But NVIDIA is not the only game in town. And I'm not talking about just AMD or Intel or even Taiwan Semiconductor, which are the stocks that a lot of us also talk about them when it comes to AI stocks and investing in the future of generative AI. I'm actually talking about the so-called picks and shovels of the semiconductor industries, the stocks and companies behind NVIDIA and AMD of the world. And these are the companies that are extremely profitable, have always been great investments for investors who take the time to dig deep into semiconductor industry, and they're not as hyped up as NVIDIA. So today's guest is a money manager and a YouTuber who focuses most of his time on researching AI stocks and semiconductor industry in general. I learned a great deal from this conversation, and I am sure most of you who are into investing in innovative growth stocks, investing in the future, would love this episode and learn a lot from it. Without further ado, let's get into the show.
The semiconductor industry is very unique in that, you know, a lot of manufacturing businesses are very hyper-competitive. As the decades have gone by, there's a lot of companies that lack differentiation. They compete with each other and essentially do the same thing. But semiconductors, owing to the fact that it is so ridiculously complicated to design, I should first say maybe like design and then patent the hardware, then design new stuff, and then to go on to manufacture it, distribute it, make sure that the software with your end customers is running properly. It takes no less than tens of millions of dollars for a full cycle for a new chip. And that's a pretty basic chip design. Massive amount of capital expenditure needed. It takes a lot of time to do these things. And so the industry is very collaborative rather than being hyper-competitive. It's a unique manufacturing industry. And so you end up with these like really interesting compartmentalized pieces of the industry where each company is specializing in a specific part of the supply chain and then maybe has like very specific tech and patents surrounding that tech within each portion of the supply chain. And so we put together the semiconductor industry flowchart as a result of a lot of research into that to hopefully break down the industry and simpler, not simple, but simpler terms to understand.
That makes a lot of sense. And it feels like from outside in, as someone who is not technical, it feels like there's two or three companies that just own the industry. But in reality, when I look at your flowchart and, you know, listen to lots of your research on your content, there's so many pieces from the moment that the need comes up in the market all the way to when a chip comes out and actually gets into the devices, right? So it's like a whole value chain of different components. And can you quickly walk us through the flowchart in the simplest possible way, as if we are like a five grader or four grader, and to kind of tell us what are those stages in chip manufacturing? And then maybe if you can, give us an example of one stock in each of those stages so that we can understand what that ecosystem look like.
Sure. I guess I could paint it with like very broad strokes first. So it is very much a cycle, like any industrial or manufacturing supply chain is. And so at the very top of the funnel, where you have some of the best, highest quality or most highest precision parts from the end of the process flowing back into the cycle again, that would be patents, tech patents, and the software itself used to design chips. So we have it broken down into EDA, electronic design automation, that would be Synopsys and Cadence, and then also the IP, the patent holders, the big patent holders like ARM Holdings. And then we'll paint with another big brushstroke here, and then you have the companies that actually use the software and the patents to design chips. You have a lot of different categories within here, from memory to logic, analog chips, but that's where NVIDIA historically falls. Intel, Qualcomm, this is some of the sexiest names in the market, fall into that middle section. And then beneath that, you have the manufacturers. Some of the companies that design chips also manufacture, but of course, in the manufacturing side, you have the giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing that handles the majority of advanced chip making. And then you have where the industry flows into software and services, which is proliferated every single sector of the economy. And then the cycle starts over again. You have some of the highest end pieces, the result of the semiconductor industry flow, completing the cycle, going back into the EDA and patent part of the flow.
So which part of the value chain is the most exciting part? Obviously, we've heard the NVIDIA one, but that's the exciting part from a stock market point of view. But from your point of view, which part of this value chain has bigger growth potential and opportunities out there?
So we're at an interesting point in the cycle right now, and it's taken a long time to get here. But for many years, the one company that got a lot of attention was ASML Holding, which often gets called a monopoly. And technically it is on one specific type of manufacturing equipment. But all of the peers of ASML Holding have absolutely exploded in popularity, especially in the last year. And this is a really interesting critical choke point in the industry, because you have the manufacturers that work with the designers to actually make the chips. But unbeknownst to most investors until, I would say, the last 6 to 12 months, those manufacturers had to get the equipment from someone. And that manufacturing equipment also has very broad portfolios of patents and tech research surrounding it. And ASML is but one of those companies. So we actually have these categorized, a whole list of them. There's dozens and dozens of them, but the Fab Five are far and away in control of this choke point of the market. They control upwards of 70% of the revenue that flows through the manufacturing part of the supply chain. And they're ASML Holding, Applied Materials, Lam Research, Tokyo Electron, and KLA Corp. And it doesn't matter who you like in this industry. If you like NVIDIA, or if you're betting on Intel making a comeback of the decade, or whoever, it doesn't matter. The chips ultimately have to go through these companies. If they're ultimately going to get manufactured and brought to market, the Fab Five definitely has a hand in their production.
This is basically a pick and shovel kind of a strategy, right? Because they're creating the pick and shovel of the industry. And as much as everybody wants to own NVIDIA and then to some extent TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor, they are the ones that kind of have the name out there and everybody loves them. But these guys, without these five that you mentioned, those guys won't be able to go anywhere. And is it fair to assume that they have really good margin and make a lot of money just because the industry is so dependent on them?
They have ridiculously good margins, regardless of what point in the cycle we're in. So obviously the bear market of 20 through the first half of 2023, or whatever, wherever you want to draw the lines with that bear market, pretty horrendous period for a lot of chip companies. Intel still, by some metrics, losing money. NVIDIA was losing money. AMD was losing money. Lots of companies in the red, but these five businesses never dipped into the red. They churn out very, very high profit margins in good times and bad. They're very powerful businesses. And many of them do a really great job of being tactical with their deployment of those profits with shareholder returns. So like Applied Materials, just as an example, one of our oldest chip stock holdings in our portfolio, deployed a ton of cash towards share buybacks during the bear market. Brilliant move. In the moment, kind of terrifying, because what's going to happen during the bear market? You know, everyone's scared to death, and you have your company like literally dipping into their balance sheet and scooping cash out of their reserves to plow it back into share buybacks. But they've been around for decades. They know these cycles. And because they're so highly collaborative with the rest of the industry, and then in addition to that, the software industry and all of their customers down the value chain, they have high visibility into what's coming down the pike, and so can get really aggressive in deploying the cash that way. Mm-hmm. Really powerful businesses.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously share buybacks, if it's done at the right price, it reduces the share count and improves earnings per share for all the shareholders. And of course, if the price also appreciates and coming out of the bear market, that's good. That's a double whammy. I want to switch to the conversation of everyone's favorite stock, which is NVIDIA. And I want to position it this way. Why NVIDIA is getting all the hype And why is like applied material is not, because it sounds like it's more profitable, it's more consistent over the course of decades in terms of profitability and value to shareholders. What's going on in terms of investor sentiment?
A lot of it probably just has to do with the cyclicality of the industry. Applied materials, yeah, it's just, it is a bit of a slower but steady business. And all of the equipment manufacturers tend to be more of a slow and steady bet. NVIDIA, yeah, they go through cycles more frequently. But there's also been this massive sea change that they themselves helped, you know, get out into harbor and now sailing out to sea, the generative AI movement, and probably a completely different conversation about whether that's hype or not. The evidence starting to mount that it's absolutely not hype. If you have Jamie Dimon saying it's not hype, it may not be hype. Jamie Dimon not really one to hop on bandwagon. So that's why NVIDIA is so exciting. It's an interesting question though, Hoda, because I remember in 2021, the same thing was happening. NVIDIA was all the rage. And we started getting nervous at the end of 2021. We've been longtime NVIDIA shareholders. So this was not like a recent bet that we made during the bear market. But same thing happening as right now, everybody's piling in. And then they just get blasted when the bear market finally hits in the aftermath of the pandemic. And then nobody wanted to talk about it. In fact, you know, we got attacked multiple times. I remember one guy in particular told me publicly multiple times, if you invest in NVIDIA right now, be prepared to not make any money for the next 10 years. Just it swings both ways though, right? You know, yeah. A year and a half ago, no one wanted to touch NVIDIA. No one wanted to talk about it. There was argument that, you know, the company's dead. It's never going to grow again, which is ridiculous. But now the pendulum swung the other way. And the cycle will repeat again at some point. There'll be a time again where no one wants to talk about NVIDIA. The conversation will pivot to, you know, will the company ever come back again? Growth is finished. It's done. And, you know,
cycle news itself. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I clearly remember after the crypto boom, everybody was saying the CEO of NVIDIA has lost his mojo and he can't predict the market and he made too much bet on crypto processing power. And I think what was missing in that picture was that they're betting on the infrastructure and the technology and the knowledge behind it, and they can adapt to new needs. So it's not, yes, this is specific processing or this use case, which was the crypto thing, was going away, but there are so many other, just where we are in terms of technology cycle, there's so many other use cases that NVIDIA can apply its knowledge, its infrastructure and technology to it. But people just don't watch your YouTube channel to understand what this going on in the market. And everybody just make a final decision around prices, based on prices. That's why people come to this conclusion. That's why I love having this conversation with you, because you're talking about what's going on underneath of this story and where the growth is coming from. Actually, you mentioned your portfolio and I know you have obviously managed money for other people, which is great. Not many YouTubers do that. And that speaks to the quality of your decisions, because if you use your research to actually buy real stocks and manage other people's money. So that's very unique. So there's multiple portfolios that you manage. There is a portfolio you have on the Stock Car platform, which you created. It's a long-term portfolio you created perhaps a year or 2 years ago. But I'd love to kind of like talk about your specific approach to portfolio when it comes, because it sounds like it's very concentrated around one sector, which is chip stocks. So how do you manage volatility and cyclicality of this industry from a portfolio management point of view? You can talk about your stock portfolio or any other portfolio. How do you balance off the cyclicality with everybody wants a little bit more stable portfolio? So what's your take in portfolio management in general?
So like our personal money is now at this point balanced pretty heavily towards the semiconductor market. So we did put our portfolio rebalance based around chip stocks on Stock Card in October. I think the initial upload was October 2022.
Yeah.
There it is. We still own all of those companies. We've made some minor adjustments. At this point, because of the rebalance and the massive outperformance in the cycle that has ensued since then, we're overweight semiconductors. Will that last for forever? TBD. But typically what we do is we do use a barbell approach to our portfolio. So we do the top-down methodology, and then we roughly speaking have two broad buckets. We have our core holdings that are your big businesses. They're big and stable, and They're not going anywhere. And I'm speaking to that not from a stock price volatility standpoint. We tend to kind of give a yawn when stock prices move up or down, even when it's really big moves. We're looking at the business itself. When I say big, stable businesses, that's one side of the bucket. The other is our long tail investments. Smaller businesses, they could get totally steamrolled by bigger competition. A few of them are going to do really well and could become the next leaders in the market of whatever industry they participate in. And those tend to be a lot more in number, usually no fewer than two dozen of them, sometimes more. So collectively across those two buckets, we try to split both buckets into growth and momentum stocks, and then also things that we think are maybe a value that the market is just overlooking. So yeah, both buckets, we have a mix of growth, momentum, and overlooked value plays. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we balance it out. The stock price thing, the volatility, it doesn't save us from some really, really crazy wild swings in portfolio value. Mm-hmm. But that's just the nature of it, right? Like, I think it doesn't matter what kind of stock you invest in. All stocks are volatile. If you look at the history of them, even like your big stable value style businesses, individually, they're just volatile. It's very difficult to eliminate that completely if you primarily invest in stocks. So that's just the name of the game.
That's just price of the entry. And when you say rebalancing, does that mean that as you look at your portfolio and then as you see NVIDIA is going up and up and down, but there are other companies out there that are really good, but they're not getting as much as attention, do you actively sell parts of your NVIDIA holding and then reallocate to those undervalued one? Or just do you let your winners win and then maybe add more money to the losers at that point?
Historically, yes, we do trim. And typically, I start getting uncomfortable when a stock becomes far in excess of 5% of our portfolio. I've been trying to learn over the years to let my winners win, but old habits do die hard. And I start getting kind of antsy when something exceeds 10% of our portfolio. So the most recent trim that we did was Apple. We've owned it for a long time. It was across our whole portfolio within our Berkshire Hathaway holdings and some ETFs and Apple stock individually. It was 10% again. Saw no reason for it to be that high of an allocation. Young, I have decades of investing ahead of me. Apple's not the high growth business it was. So yeah, we rebalance. Yeah, historically it does tend to be about individual allocations, percentages in individual stocks, but you're trying to unlearn that a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's interesting in terms of a couple of things you mentioned. Yeah, obviously you're young and you have decades in front of you, so you might be able to, you can, and you have the right mindset and you can tolerate volatility. So you may be able to just let some of the winners win. But what I really liked in what you were saying about Apple is that it's not just only owning Apple AAPL as a ticker, but if you own S&P 500 and some other ETFs, and then if you look at how Apple is prominent in some of those ones, and then you put it all together, then you realize the exposure to Apple or some of these so Magnificent Seven kind of stocks, you end up like, everyone say, oh, I don't have NVIDIA in my portfolio, or I only have a little bit. But in reality, if you have S&P 500 as part of your 401k or some other ETFs, you have exposure to a lot of these things, and you're owning the risk of them maybe going down and going through the cyclicality. So it's not only just that unique one liner when it comes to managing portfolio. So I really like that point. You already gave us lots of good stocks to think about, especially those five Fab Fives that you mentioned. But everybody, as you know, in the stock market, even the best investors would still love to get the best stock to buy now ideas. So I want to kind of force you to think about one stock. It could be one of those Fab Five or any other one. But what is the one that you're researching now and you're excited about?
I can tell you the last thing that we hit the buy button on, and it was an initial position that we took after watching it for at least a couple of years, is Accelus Technologies, ACLS. In our book, it's a small cap. We deviate a bit from the typical definition of what a small cap is. We tend to look at it from the size of the market the company participates in and what percentage of the market does it have? Like what slice of the pie does it have? So in our book, Excellus is a small cap because it competes primarily with Applied Materials in one specific type of semiconductor manufacturing equipment used especially in recent years for power chips, next gen power chips. So electric vehicles, lots of other stuff, you know, and any electronic system is going to use some mix of power chips. And so, yeah, we've done a couple of deep dives into it. That's the most recent thing we hit the buy button on just last week.
But that brings me to sort of one of my last two questions is that where do you get these ideas? What are the sources you use to research, educate yourself, perhaps come up with these new stock ideas? Because if I read the news out there, I would never come across ACLS as a stock pick because nobody talks about it. And that's the beauty of discovery, right? So you must have a very good process in terms of researching and educating yourself and gathering information. Can you open that window to us for us and tell us where, how do you do that research on your side?
Sure. Well, you know, I can give a plug for what you do here because my process is not palatable to many people, to be completely honest. So like a great place to source ideas like this is a place like StockCard, where you can look at whole industries and see all the companies listed in these industries. But typically what we do when we're researching a new industry that we've identified as having, you know, some sort of good macro influence that we think will carry it forward for many, many years, we sort of try to whittle it down into segments. You know, how does the industry work? What are the different components of it? And then we just start doing like a name dump under each category. Who are all the companies? Who are all the public and maybe even private, if there's large private companies in a specific industry that participate? And oftentimes the best source to find that is in companies' 10Ks, their annual reports. Again, not very palatable. Gen AI can help with this, but you have to fact check it because sometimes it's wrong, depending on where the chatbot is getting its information from, who's been feeding it and what they've been feeding it. But at any rate, yeah, open up a 10K. One of the first things I usually do when I open up a 10K is I hit Control F and type in the search competitors or competitor or something like that and try to find a section where the company breaks down who everyone else is that they compete against and then start peeling back the layers from there.
That is awesome. That's a very good tip. Because you could find all the other companies that are in the same space that you're excited about, but you maybe not everybody talks about. I love it. I love that approach. So Nick, we've been talking to us almost more than 29 minutes. So I think it's the time to talk about where can people find you. I know you have a very good and active Discord channel and YouTube, but tell us about everywhere that people can come and read and follow your stock ideas or join your community. Love to give people a chance to connect with you.
See, we are on YouTube. We are Chip Stock Investor on YouTube. Casey and I are both on Twitter. I think we're at N. Rossolillo and at K. Rossolillo on Twitter /X. And then the Discord thing is brand new. Still kind of getting our feet wet with that and how it works. But we also have that. We're experimenting with this new concept that we have that I guess I just sort of on the fly have dubbed re-media. Hopefully
that's
a nice play on words.
That's good.
Giving media businesses a second chance to do it over and also provide research in that context. So
that's excellent.
Yeah,
and is Discord channel where people can get some of your research on some of your ideas, or is it still the YouTube is the best place to be?
It's a bit of a hybrid at the moment, but all of the chip stock research we do is always going to be on the YouTube channel. We do have some additional things going on the Discord channel, and we're experimenting with how that'll work and how that'll look going forward.
Makes a lot of sense. That's pretty good. So folks, that was an excellent conversation. I learned a lot about the picks and shovels of stocks of the semiconductor industry and how this industry is actually working and how we can invest in it. That is not just investing in hyper stock, but investing in those truly profitable and growing companies in this space. If you like these kind of conversations, there are a few other ones on the channel. I recently had a conversation with Steve Symington, who talked about his blast stock methodology. It's a really good investment methodology for picking those high growth stocks. I also had a conversation with Matt Wolodarski, who has this fantastic framework called Wealthy Owl Framework, and it's for finding multi-bagger stocks. I love to invite you to watch some of those episodes. If you have missed them, the link to them is in the show notes. There will be the great next watch after this episode. Thank you for watching, and I hope if you watch until this point and enjoy this episode, make sure to subscribe to the channel. That helps us to grow the channel and put this great content in front of more long-term fundamental investors like you. See you next time.